Time for us to head back to the hotline as we bring in our very next guest, Michael Warschauer, our Hollywood juke guru, joining us right now. Michael, thank you so much for the time, my friend. How are you?
Doing well. Happy to talk to you guys again.
Well, great to have you on, and boy, it's been a while since we last spoke with you, and I think the last time we had you on, we were talking about the second episode of the final season of Game of Thrones, and I think it was also shortly after the release of Avengers Endgame. Matt Douglas and I have both had the opportunity to see that movie, and I was blown away by just how well this thing continues to do week after week, and I want to begin with both of those subjects. Which do you think has really kind of had a bigger cultural impact, the entire final season of Game of Thrones or Avengers Endgame?
You know, I think that they both have had just an incredible impact in their own ways, and I think we'll see more and more in the coming years just how much of an impact they have. But I would say right now, I think that Game of Thrones probably had one, just sort of like the bigger impact just of the culture overall. As I think we talked about before, this is really one of the last TV shows that we might see where everyone kind of watched it together. And it was just sort of this one kind of monolithic cultural presence. And Avengers certainly was the same way in its own right, you know, a culmination of 10 years of films. But I think one of the things about Game of Thrones is, especially if you were on Twitter at all during the run of this last season, it was sort of like everyone was watching it all together. Twitter especially, yeah, was one big kind of shared viewing party. So I think that as far as like a cultural moment, Game of Thrones maybe had a bigger one just as far as how the culture of watching pop culture together is changing. But I do think that Avengers, I mean, this is one of the most massive film franchises of all time. We're seeing its impact as far as how it's affecting other film franchises, from the DC universe to just sort of every new shared universe and franchise that we have popping up. So I think that they're both going to have long-lasting impacts, but I think that Game of Thrones is significant in that it's probably the last time that, as a culture, so many people watch one TV show together.
Michael, why do you think so many people were critical of Game of Thrones in this final season?
Well, I think part of it is that you have book readers who have been following this story for so long and hoping to get to a conclusion that they've been dreaming of for so long, kind of not coming to fruition. But I also think that a big part of it is just it's very hard to cap off these massive shows that are so reliant on an endgame, as we saw, several years ago with Lost, another big show that kind of captured everyone, and we were all waiting to see how it ended. It's very hard to wrap that up in a satisfying way that can get the millions and millions of people watching it satisfied. So I think that's part of it. I think that there was just sort of some weaker storytelling in these past two seasons as their time that they were, the amount of episodes shrunk each season. So I think they just had less time to kind of work with the story that really was slow moving going on in the first couple seasons. But I think the biggest thing is just, there's such massive expectations on these franchises. And, well, while we saw Endgame pull it off really, really well, it's a hard thing to do when you're producing, 10 hours of footage every season to wrap that up into a really satisfying conclusion.
So what was your take on Game of Thrones? Did you appreciate the end? Did you not like it? What camp were you in? Were you right petitioning the writers?
I'm in the gently disappointed category. Right. I was sort of prepared to be disappointed. I think that, like I said, they kind of rushed the storytelling in the last two seasons, and character arcs in previous seasons that took full seasons to unravel. The same arcs happened in 20 minutes in the new season. So I think it just moved a little too fast for its own good at the end. Maybe if they'd had a couple more episodes to let things breathe a little bit, it would have been just fine. But I think that their execution was a little off, but the ideas they had were pretty in line with the rest of the show.
Don't you kind of feel, though, that was kind of not the character arc aspect of it, but it was a show that let you down quite a bit as far as the characters, the guys you were rooting for would die, the people you weren't rooting for would also die, and you'd kind of lose those permanent characters throughout the show. And I kind of thought that was the beauty of it. And the way it ended certainly wasn't the way I wanted it to end, but the show's done that to me numerous times before, and I've come to accept it, I feel.
Absolutely. I think it was such a show that never gave you what you want, and so I think it's a little bizarre that as we got to the end, people were expecting it to give it what they want. So I think there's certainly a large amount of just viewer anticipation that really goes into how we view the way the story unfolded itself.
Michael Warshaw, our Hollywood guru, joining us here on Bullseye on the Afternoon. All right, well, we take a look now at the leader this past weekend at the box office. Aladdin passed $100 million projections, did extraordinarily well, taking in, last I saw, right around $112 million in its opening weekend. Thoughts on this version of the movie and the reviews that it got?
Well, I haven't had a chance to see it yet, but I think that this is a really interesting kind of case study for Disney as a whole right now. They've had a run of success with these remakes of live-action remakes of their original animated films. We've seen The Jungle Book and Beauty and the Beast already. We have Lion King coming out later this year. One of the big knocks that I've heard about this new Aladdin is that it's very CGI-heavy and that so much of it is just sort of created on a computer as opposed to having some of the real magic that Disney has so frequently offers. Will Smith has also had very big shoes to fill, coming in as playing the genie from Robin Williams in the original animated film. But overall, I've heard pretty solid reviews. It's a good, fun, family-friendly movie. I think you probably have a lot of people, as with every remake, who are very hesitant because it's not exactly the same as the beloved original that is such a huge part of their lives. But I think that Disney has really found something that works for them, where they're taking these films and they're presenting them to a new generation with new technology that wasn't available when the original film came out 20 years ago. And so they're really doing a good job, I think, of keeping their stories original, keeping their intellectual property protected and pumping out money. But more than anything, I think that they're doing a really good job of creating these like really high-budget, family-friendly movies, which have kind of been in trouble for the last decade or so in the rise of CGI. So it's kind of good for them in that regard to have these successful and pretty decent remakes on their hands.
Can Aladdin keep that top spot this coming weekend, or you think that's going to be overtaken by Rocketman?
I don't know if it's going to hang on to that this weekend, because not only is it going up against Rocketman, but it's also going up against a new Godzilla movie, Godzilla King of the Monsters. The 2014 remake of that franchise grossed $200 million, so there's a good chance that it will continue that momentum. It has a great cast and looks to be another challenger. Rocketman also, I think, has a really good shot at being kind of a box office buster this weekend, where it's carrying the momentum of the musical biopic from Bohemian Rhapsody, which obviously did very well in the box office and the Academy Awards this past year. It's very possible that they are able to take that momentum and pull in a lot of audiences from that. It also has good reviews. It's at 89% on Rotten Tomatoes. It's already performed pretty well overseas, bringing in about $6 million already. So I think it's going to be hard for Aladdin to keep that top spot, but it'll be interesting to see who actually does come in, or if Aladdin can keep it, how fractured the box office is and who gets that second and third spot.
Well, sticking with the box office theme for just another moment here, you know, one of the movies I think that certainly performed a lot better than most thought that it might, Olivia Wilde's Booksmart, did pretty well. What do we know about this movie, and why is it that the critic reviews were so incredibly positive?
This is a movie that has, since its premiere, really just been exceeding expectations and just doing incredibly well. I premiered at South by Southwest earlier this spring to just like universal acclaim. I think everything I've heard about this movie is that it's just a new and unique spin on what's kind of a typical story. It's about two high school students played by Caitlin Deaver and Beanie Feldman from Lady Bird, and also the younger sister of Jonah Hill. They're two best friends who spend their whole high school career just focused as much as they can on school. And as soon as they get to graduation and get accepted into Ivy League schools, they realize that all the people who've been having fun and going out and partying and skipping out on responsibilities also got into Ivy League schools. So they decide that they're going to spend this one night having as much fun as they can, doing all of the typical high school party shenanigans and making sure that they get that in their lives. From everything I've heard, it's just a very unique story told from their perspective. The two of them have incredible chemistry across the board. And it just sounds like it's one of those movies that is a warm, unique summer kind of charmer. I think it reminds me a little bit of at least the buzz around it, around Superbad, another movie that had very low expectations about these two best friends about to go to college, and kind of flip that script on its head in a unique way there. So I think that it just has that unique factor going for it, and it sounds like it's going to be one of those surprise performers of the summer.
Michael, you just blew my mind. I knew I had seen Elizabeth Feldstein somewhere. I've been watching What We Do in the Shadows. She's on that. I couldn't place her face. Now you've opened my mind. That's Jonah Hill's sister. I'll be darned.
Yeah, well, it's a small business.
Yeah, no kidding. Very good.
It's a very small business. Yeah. I mean, and it's interesting, too, how these are the kinds of roles that really kind of bring out that whole connection that a lot of people just didn't know about. But I've seen a ton of previews. I don't want to transition into some TV here. I've seen a ton of previews for this new show called Hot Zone, which tackles a very interesting subject that I feel like over the last, I don't know, 15 years or so, we've kind of forgotten about. It's almost like this kind of just got totally wiped away, about the Ebola virus. The thoughts on this, and does this have a chance to really exceed expectations?
Sure, yeah. I think this is a really interesting summer show to keep track of. It's coming out on the National Geographic Network, which has been really trying to get into original programming over the last few years, and it follows a potential outbreak of Ebola in 1989 in the United States that would have decimated the population and sort of been an unstoppable virus. Of course, we know from our own history that it didn't end up spreading, but it's supposed to be a very fact-based, science-driven look at this kind of unique period and an issue that really is kind of still something that can provide us a scare today, whether with Ebola or other viruses. It also has a great cast: Juliana Margulies, Liam Cunningham from Game of Thrones, Noah Emmerich, Topher Grace, and more. So everything I've heard so far indicates that the acting is tremendous, and even in its weaker moments of storytelling, it's supported by some really terrific actors who bring it to life. It reminds me a little bit, just on the surface, of HBO's miniseries Chernobyl, which is airing right now, of telling the factual telling of a real life event. The Prestige Network counterpart, Chernobyl, seems to be probably a step ahead of this as far as quality, but this will certainly be a really interesting summer watch, and especially now that we're getting into the season of mostly streaming shows, I think it'll be kind of cool to have this episodic miniseries play out with such a unique topic. It's also very interesting to see just how National Geographic has been adapting in this cable and streaming landscape. And so they have a lot kind of riding on this as being one of their big signature original programs. So that'll be an interesting thing to watch as well.
All right, before we get to your picks to click, I've got to ask you about a show my brother was telling me about yesterday. It's called is it called The Bash Brothers? Or it's like a Bash Brothers mockery with Andy Samberg and Justin Timberlake. It looks hilarious. My brother told me it was fantastic. I've not seen this. Have you heard of this? It's like a Bash Brothers like a mockery, like a mockumentary. What exactly is this?
It is from The Lonely Island. It's the unauthorized story of the Bash Brothers. Justin Timberlake is not actually in it, but it's Andy Samberg and Akiva Schaffer, who's also from The Lonely Island. They're mostly the two stars, but there are appearances by Maya Rudolph and Jenny Slate, among other comedians. This is the goofiest thing that you'll see all summer. It's a 30-minute visual poem, somewhat in the style of like Beyonce's Lemonade, where the two of them play Mark McGuire and Jose Canseco, who are their real-life childhood heroes as they grew up in Oakland in the 80s. And the whole premise is that while they were teammates, the two of them recorded a rap album that never got released. And so this is all the music videos and all of the songs from it. It is a truly insane and absurd story and idea, and like everything about it is just ridiculous. But if you're a fan of The Lonely Island and their SNL digital shorts or their album, or even their really highly underrated movie Pop Star from a few years ago, you'll absolutely love it. It's just sort of absurd, goofy comedy and comedy music at its best. I've watched it once already and am very eagerly looking forward to watching it again. It definitely follows in the mold of two of Andy Samberg's recent projects that he had on HBO the last few years, 7 Days in Hell, where he played a tennis player that played a never-ending tennis match, and another one called Tour de Pharmacy about Tour de France cyclists who did a lot of steroids instead. So it follows that goofy sports line that he's been going with the last few years, but this is truly one of the weirdest but funniest things that you'll see on streaming this summer.
Very good stuff. Now I'm really excited to watch that. My brother couldn't stop talking about it at our family gathering yesterday. Should give you an idea as to what our family gatherings are like, but he loved it. He said, you got to check it out. So, all right, Michael, what do you have for this week's Picks to Click?
Well, first, streaming on Netflix starting this week is a new movie called Always Be My Baby. It stars Ali Wong and Randall Park as two former childhood friends who everyone thought would end up together, who reconnect as adults. It's sort of following in that Netflix rom-com mold that we've been seeing so recently, but it has great early buzz and looks to be a pretty fun, light early summer movie to check out on Netflix. The other one is a new show called Nosferatu. It's premiering on AMC. It's based off of a book from a couple of years ago, and it seems truly wild. It's about a young woman who discovers that she has the supernatural ability to track an immortal man who feeds on the souls of children. So it's a very strange but interesting plot. I think if you like American Horror Story, this might be a show to check out.
Outstanding. Well, Michael, as always, we certainly appreciate the time. Thank you so much for joining us here to talk about all these items today, and we certainly look forward to doing this again soon.
Thanks a lot. Me too.
Thank you very much, Michael. Again, our Hollywood guru, Michael Warschauer, joining us here on Bullseye on the Afternoon. Well, we covered a lot of ground there, from the cultural impact of the Game of Thrones and Avengers Endgame all the way to Bash Brothers.